Gentlemen, we're going to get started. It's 1 o'clock, our appointed time. We do not have a quorum at this time, but we don't want to get in the habit of starting late. So we're going to get things started right away. Before we dive into testimony, I would point out to members that we have some reports in our packet that are from the testimony of Tuesday. And those are for your information to read through at your own leisure. We will not be covering them in committee today. With that, I would like to welcome our first testifier, Pamela Wheelock. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Pamela Wheelock. I'm Vice President of University Services at the University of Minnesota, and we will have a couple of other presenters here today. Who will be joining me later, but let me just start by with a thank you, which is probably something you don't hear often enough, but is very important for us. You are, the state of Minnesota is an important partner with the University of Minnesota to help us ensure that we have the competitive functional facilities to advance our program. And you have been helpful, and we are in the process right now at the university with your support of building the last of our four biodiversity and discovery buildings at the north of the Twin Cities, the TCF Bank Stadium facility. This is our microbiology research facility. You can see that on the lower part of and right part of the screen. And then as well, we are in the design phases to begin the work on the University of Minnesota Crookston campus for the Wellness Center. This is in addition to much other support that you have provided and many other projects that we have recently completed, like the nano and physics facility on our campus, but it has been important support and we are appreciative of that. We're here today to talk about our request before the legislature this year for a 2015 potential bonding bill. And facilities, as you might imagine, are an important part of helping the university advance its mission. As Minnesota's only public land-grant university, we have three core missions for the university: research and discovery, which you hear a lot about the new information, the new knowledge that's being generated at the university that's being used in different industries and different fields to advance our social interests, teaching and learning, and outreach and public engagement. All three are core to us, and all three involve the use of functional and competitive facilities to advance our mission. We are going to try an experiment, or I am. I'm hoping that this will work. And Mike Bertelson, who has joined me at the podium, will help advance this. But this is a short video that it was a short video.
Very short.
Many of our facilities were built 60 or more years ago, so they were modern in the middle of the 20th century.
There are new developments. Science is moving very quickly. An aging building needs upgrades in order to accommodate the new developments.
Quite often, you can update a building for a fraction of the cost of building a new building and yet get new life out of it.
The state has really responded and been a very positive partner for the university, and we're very fortunate that they have made it a priority as well to invest in the infrastructure that helps support the teaching and research and outreach of the institution.
I'm very driven by understanding infectious diseases, understanding why do we have diseases, but more importantly, how diseases get transmitted and what can we do to prevent them. Minnesota has some of the largest producers and larger companies related to food, so they do need the research that comes out of the University of Minnesota. The existing facilities are very inefficient for the work we do. We cannot clean them well, we cannot use them right away between studies. These facilities are important to the overall sustainability of Minnesota's agriculture, from pigs to turkeys to cows to beef to you name it. And also to have a safe food supply.
A
Life sciences are exploding at the seams. We are driven by challenges in the environment, healthcare, major societal problems that hinge on solutions in biology. Students need to learn how we know what we know. And one way to accomplish that is by engaging them directly in research from day one.
Coming to a school like the University of Minnesota offers them the opportunity to get involved in important research that is globally recognized.
We don't have the kind of flexible space that is necessary to do inquiry-based learning.
The greenhouse structure is so compromised that it can't protect the plants from the Minnesota climate. I think it would be fantastic to take students into a space that is truly inspiring in terms of feeling like you're in a very different environment on another part of the planet.
The diversity of life matters. What we study is the basis for our survival.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I may have had a better view of that than the members did, but we can make that available to your staff, too, should anyone want to look at those images again.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Ms. Wheelock. I'm going to officially call this meeting to order. We now have a quorum. I didn't have a chance to ask you before you started your presentation if you'd like to take questions during or after your presentation.
Whenever it's convenient for you and
we
the members.
We will do questions during. Members will get my attention, and I will interrupt you when appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So moving on, the University of Minnesota as a system is busier than ever. You can see by these statistics we're serving more students in some significant measure than we did in early of this century. Last semester, 72% of those students were University of Minnesota undergraduate were Minnesota residents, and we've tried hard to keep this affordable and to make it accessible to students. It's also important about the role we play in the state. 100% of the degrees that are granted in the state of Minnesota for dentistry, pharmacy, and veterinary medicine come from the University of Minnesota, and 85% of the medical degrees. And our four-year graduation rates have doubled since 1997. So we are proud of the progress we're making, and our facilities are a key component of that. In terms of research, the university, again, is Minnesota's only research facility. And it has achieved great progress in elevating its stature in the country and among its competitors in terms of the amount of research funding and the translation of that research into new business development. It's also generated a lot of alums that happen to live across the state. There are almost 34,000 University of Minnesota alumni living in your districts, and many of them hold more than one degree. There is a very good chance that you have a University of Minnesota employee that lives in your district as well, in addition to our current student enrollment and the distribution throughout the state. We have two key assets that we use to accomplish our mission, people and place. The facilities are really a critical tool for supporting that academic mission. It may make a difference in the student experience about what kind of housing the student lives in, the space that they learn in, whether the laboratory space is functional and can achieve its program, whether the space is properly heated or cooled. It provides a competitive advantage not just in recruiting students, but also faculty and staff who engage with those students and run the functions of the university. And it is oftentimes an aspect of whether we are able to achieve a grant or research, a grant for research or a gift from a donor. But the flip side of that is it also has some significant impact for us on our operational budget and presents not only an ongoing cost for operations and maintenance, but a commitment long term to maintain those facilities. We have a number of facilities across the state. We have 29 million square feet of space across our system. We have five unique campuses in our system, in addition to 19 research and outreach centers and field stations. So we have a very big footprint throughout the state. So we have spent some time and effort to try to better understand what is the condition of our facilities, how do we best manage those facilities, how do we not only deal with the crisis when it occurs, but be able to move into preventive maintenance to ensure that our buildings are not a handicap for our ability to advance our mission in the University of Minnesota. What I'd like to do is introduce Mike Bertelson, who's an assistant vice president and manages facility management at the Twin Cities campus and provides support for planning for our facilities on a system-wide basis. And we'd like to share with you a little bit of information about what we know of the condition of our facilities across the state.
Thank you. I'm just going to interrupt for a moment before Mike starts. If you could go back a couple slides to the one where you had the number of alumni, is that just in the districts represented in this room, or is that in the entire state?
That is an excellent question. For it's the members in this room.
That's kind of what I thought, because it seemed like a rather low number for a statewide number, since you have many more than that number of students. So you went through and carefully selected the students that were from our districts.
Mr. Chair, I can assure you that I did not, but our capable staff did that. Yes.
Well, we appreciate the personal attention. Thank you very much. Please introduce yourself for the record, Mr. Bertelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mike Bertelson. I'm the Associate Vice President for Facilities Management for the Twin Cities campus.
And Mike, before you start, I do have a question from Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, going back to actually the first slide, I believe, you said as far as number of students, we've had an 11% increase since 2001. What's the recent trend? I know the UMD campus is down in terms of students and things. What's the most recent trends at the other campuses?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I have that information with me right now. Our expectation is we have flat to modest enrollment growth because of the long-term commitment that's associated with servicing that population of students. It may move from college to college depending on the economy and the competitiveness of those programs. But overall, it's relatively flat for a modest rate of growth, and we can provide more detail to you.
A follow-up, Representative Obama.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one other quick question. With regard to scholarships there, that slide you had, how many percent or whatever are Minnesota residents on those scholarships?
Ms. Wheelock.
Mr. Chair, I'm actually looking to see if my colleague, the CFO, has that information. We'll have to provide that as follow-up to you.
Thank you. I'd appreciate it.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
All right. Thank you. Well, long before we come to you with a capital recommendation, we have already spent a great deal of time and looked through a lot of information to make sure what identify the priorities of the campus and of the university. One of the core tools we have for that is what we call the facility condition assessment. Our target is that it's a single enterprise source that has the most accurate, up-to-date information of all our condition information for the facilities across the system. And every so many years, we go through and review each of those buildings and document both with pictures and data and what that information is. That helps us keep up to date on the status, not just of the age of the building, just from a mathematical perspective, but really what's the functional nature of each of those components. We know that over time, we've done modeled what our age of our facilities are against what the rest of higher ed is. And we know that one of the issues that's been interesting for us thinking about, there are certain construction eras and construction standards over time. So we've kind of put them in those pre-war sort of time period. The buildings were built to be at universities, sort of monument sort of structure, pillars, strong, big, a lot of space. They were incredibly well built, built to last a very, very long time. The enormous growth, though that happened post-World War II, was much, as you know, architecturally maybe less significant, much more quickly built, more cheaply built. We found that a lot of those systems just were not built to last in the same way that the things had been built before then. And as you move into a more complex era, really the last 10, 15 years, I think people have understood what it means to make a strong building infrastructure with building systems and technology so that we can manage buildings in a much different way
than we could before. And so we see, you can see both in this chart the university space history, and then the more of an average of higher ed facilities across the country. You can see the university and Minnesota built sort of ahead of that curve. So we have some more buildings in that kind of pre-war era, and our profile of our buildings is greater and older than the average across the country.
Excuse me, Mr. Bertelsen.
Yes, sir.
I was at a meeting this morning of the Capitol Building Commission. And as you know, we're remodeling that 100-year-old building, and it's one of those substantial ones that you talked about earlier. But part of that effort is to try and locate original furniture from the building. Do you know if you have any original Capitol furniture in any of your facilities?
Mr. Chair, we do have a reuse center. Whenever anybody wants us to not use something, what's not good for someone often is good for someone else. We'll put out an APB.
Please do that.
We'll give it a look for that. When we look across the information that comes from that facility condition assessment, we gather a variety of information. We can sort it a few ways. So I want to show you both from a numerical perspective what that looks like by each of our campuses, what the gross square feet is, the estimated replacement value, and I want to emphasize that this is the way we do this methodology is not to current standards. This is be if you were going to build a building just with what's in the building the way it is then. So if it was a building that was built without AC, so building a building to that same sort of look. Certainly it's without the modern kind of upgrades of technology. So it tends to underestimate the replacement value. Then we look at what the projected 10-year need is. So the architects and engineers who look through each of the buildings identify what's working, what's not, how aged is it, and from their perspective, what is the value of the cost, the things that they would recommend that we are keeping a priority eye on that they imagine really should be considered for replacement in the next 10 years. Not whole buildings, these are by building components, but a roof, a fan unit, a carpeting, windows, elevators, so be it. The last piece becomes a metric that we use to track the relative health of any given building or campus. It's the 10-year need divided by the replacement value. So it gives you a sense of a relative health. A low number means things are the lower the number, the smaller the need, the higher the number, the greater the need. That becomes evident as we look at the map way to represent this to show you a picture of the campus. I believe you were given samples of these maps in your packet that you have on large sheets. That put each of the buildings on each of the campuses across the state into a color code. So much, as you can see, the green is in really a good shape. That means the FCNI is under one. It's really an excellent shape, often new or recently renovated. Something in the red means it's critical. It's above its replacement value. Its need is greater than 60% of its replacement value. You can see places, not surprisingly, some of the areas of the red are in the Knoll area, the oldest part of campus, smaller, very old buildings. The green are things that are really new, the Biodiscovery District, the football stadium, and some other buildings which have been renovated and turned green. Northrop is a green. Once was red and now is green. That's what we want. So that's a way you can see those maps in front of you. Another way to show them is this gives you a sense of history, and I believe this chart is in your folder as well. From the left, it adds a sense of time. So to your far left is Eddy Hall, the oldest building on the Twin Cities campus from 1890. And it's very, our oldest and not a very big building. Also, the size of each of the squares gives you a sense of the size of the building. So Eddy Hall, old, not in good condition, and quite small. Whereas if you look kind of in the middle of your chart, you can see Mayo, a very large red block right in the center, is almost 900,000 square feet, a building which is really a collection of buildings built over time. It's dozens of roof sections, 150 separate air handling units, a building which is more of a potluck almost assortment of a building components. As you can see, then, obviously, the things that get newer along the line of history, they become green.
Thank you. Representative Lilly has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, when I was driving in this morning, Sid Hartman was ripping the legislature that, and I'm about not having a building that we're, I guess we're not funding. Is that in here or on here? Is that one of your top three requests? Or because, boy, he was really saying, maybe I could quote him. No, I probably shouldn't.
Mr. Bertelsen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I happen to be listening to Sid this morning on that same section. So what on the he was referring, of course, to the athletic facilities that are being talked about, the new athletic village and football facilities, projected $150 million project, and his belief would request would be that you would fund some of that project. That is, this is not part of the university's capital request for you.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that, the direction and the intention of the university leadership is our athletic projects are donor financed or privately financed, so that has been our direction about the fundraising campaign, and I understand from talking to the athletic director, he feels that significant progress is being made on the fundraising, so we'll keep you informed.
So which is it, the Sid Hartman facility or the Leon Lilly facility? I mean, if one of them gave enough money, I'm sure they could get their name on it.
Probably Sid.
Follow-up, Representative Lilly? Did you have a follow-up question?
No, sir. Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what? How much money is remaining to be raised for that, for the athletic facility?
Mr. Chair, I can't say that I have a current estimate on that. I believe it's
ballpark.
I believe
number.
The CFO might have an estimate of that, a current estimate. Mr. Richard Fitzenreiter, who is the CFO for the University of Minnesota, or Fitz.
Please identify yourself for the record, Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Richard Fitzenreiter. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer at the University of Minnesota. The way we count money for capital projects at the University of Minnesota, particularly projects that are expected or hoped to be fundraised entirely, is I only count money that has a signed pledge agreement with the University of Minnesota Foundation. And based on that approach, the university athletic department has raised approximately $51.5 million towards their $150 million capital project for the athletic village today. They are continuing aggressively. They have you'll often hear larger numbers. As I constantly remind people, and you all know, don't believe what you read in the paper, particularly in Sid's column. but the project has a ways to go. They have a large list of prospects. So oftentimes people confuse the prospect list with what's actually bookable towards the project. So people are talking. They're not being intentionally invasive. They're just confusing prospect lists with actual. And the project is continuing to work aggressively on naming opportunities and philanthropy.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that as well, that you will hear about, or it was somewhat accurately portrayed in the recent newspaper article, there is also cash on hand, cash that has been received in addition to pledges, and so that will be used to fund the schematic design phase, and we'll be taking that to our Board of Regents in February for an approval to begin just the planning phase.
Thank you. I'd just like to remind the media that the opinion of testifiers is not necessarily the opinion of the committee. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fitzenreiter, so get it straight. It's unlikely that Mr. Hartman would kick in the remainder.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
If he has any interest, we can get him a donor pledge card.
Representative Albright has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wheelock, I'm looking at that diagram that you have up on the screen right now, and it's kind of a question of prioritization. I see a number of older buildings in red, but then I also see, as you mentioned, the type is extremely small. So, the Mayo Building, is one, and then two more current times, there's two buildings back to back, 142 and 144, that were built in the 1970s.
I'm not sure. I don't know if I can.
Phillips maybe is one, and
Moose. And yeah, Moose and PWB.
And so my question is really to the point of I see your capital request and what it would pertain to. I'm just trying to get my a better understanding in terms of with buildings of such repair or disrepair languishing or waiting for funding, that, as you state, particularly with medical engineering, with mechanical engineering, with the science, technology, and engineering, and what emphasis that we have, I'm curious as to not an explanation, but more of a commentary in terms of why, in particular, those, the Mayo, the Phillips, and the other wouldn't have a higher prioritization from the U.
So, Mr. Chair, that actually leads nicely to the next part of our presentation, but the short answer is we use a number of various strategies, and one of the what you see here is about the facility condition, and what we also like to do when we prepare our recommendations for the President and the Board of Regents and the Governor and the Legislature is to think about the combination of the facility condition and the impact on program. So it may be that there are some parts of the facility, in particular, we may have a very bad roof on a building that drives the discussion here about its ranking, but it has very minimal impact on the program that occurs in that building, whereas some other facility might have more of an immediate need driven by the program investment. This, though, is a very good indication of our priorities for the use of HEPR funding and for our own R&R, more so than necessarily the driver, the sole driver, about what drives our request to the state for its partnership both on HEPR funding and new project investment. The other thing I would add is this is just the snapshot for the Twin Cities campus. Of course, we think about the whole statewide system and develop our requests around that. I would also add in the far left, some of those buildings, some of those smaller, very well-built buildings aren't very flexible. So the ability to invest in that space and then use it to meet your current mission in a meaningful way might be limited. Eddie Hall, for example, might be good for office space, but if what we really need is laboratory space or classroom space, that may not be the building we invest in first. So this is an input for the decision-making, but it's not the only source of information to guide our decisions about the investment of funds. It's most relevant for R&R and HEPR funding decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lilly has a question. Representative Lilly, did you have a question?
No, Mr. Chair, no, I'm fine. We moved on.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with respect to the slide that you just saw about facility condition, and of course this is across our system, but we have a variety of tools in the tool belt, if you will, to help improve and renew the condition of our buildings. HEPR funding, which is the subject of our request here today, our number one priority, is a very important component. That funding is prescripted in state law to certain investments in the infrastructure of the building. It's not intended to be to expand or renew the programmatic space, but rather to protect the integrity of the infrastructure of the building. R&R are from our operating funds, so those are small to mid-sized capital improvements. It might be fixing something in the building in the HVAC system or some repair to the steps leading into the building, but they're not intended to be major capital projects. It's more about fix it as you go on an operating basis. We do, internally within the university, we have a structure for utility rates that captures some investment opportunity as well for utility infrastructure improvements, and clearly taking out of our inventory a facility that can no longer effectively be maintained or is not prudent to continue to invest in is a part of our strategy. We've removed about 11 buildings in the last dozen or so years that we really have determined aren't prudent to continue to invest in and will lack the functionality after that investment that we need. And then major capital projects, we've talked about some of the renewals that have occurred. You provided funding last legislative session to the university to renew Tate, which will have some of our physics and astronomy and earth sciences classes and faculty in that building. That's on the historic mall. It's an important building for the university. It's a large building and will continue to play a vital role in achieving our mission for another 50 or 80 years down the road. Walter Library, Falwell, and of course projects across the system as well. So we have done some major capital investments to renew that building inventory as well and to extend the useful life and to better leverage the public investment that's already been made. In terms of the priorities.
Thank you. Representative Hausman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the renewal of one, this is on the Heeper list, number one, mechanical engineering. Last year, that amount was estimated at 32. The request now for renewal phase three is 13. Does that mean $19 million was out of last year's Heeper? Has a portion of that building now been done?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I'll certainly welcome Mr. Bertelsen to add on to this, but that that building is continuing to be used, and so we knew that at the outset that we would need to phase that work, and so it was a question of how many phases over what period of time. So I believe, if memory serves me, in the last Heeper appropriation, $22 million of that was used for the next phase, and so this is for funding of the phase after that.
Correct. This would be this would be for the west wing. We used the funds for the last time toward the north, to the north wing, and this would finish the project.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chair, in terms of capital budget request priorities, these are reviewed, recommended by the President, and reviewed by the Board of Regents, and adopted by the Board of Regents. They actually adopt a six-year capital plan. Many of these projects obviously have some long lead time, not only in the design and plans and the financing that needs to be put together, but just programmatically as we think particularly about relocation of existing functions and how do we clear buildings and make them available for renovation or clear sites for construction. So this is a six-year plan that gets updated annually by the Board of Regents, and clearly they have criteria in place that looks at how it ensures student success or supports our ability to advance research or fulfill our statewide mission, as well as protect the public investment that's already been made in these facilities and our assets, and to responsibly manage that given the limited resources that we have. As we've illustrated, we always feel like we could effectively use more resources, both internally and externally generated, than we have. And so the prioritization of those investments is a really critical function. So with respect to our 2015 capital request, as you will note, the number one priority established by the Board of Regents is our Heeper funding request, followed by a replacement of our VET isolation facility and the St. Paul greenhouse replacement. So for Heeper, this is, again, as I indicated, this is for expenses and investments that are eligible under state law for Heeper financing. These are really critical building components or building infrastructure like roof replacement, tuck pointing, window replacement, HVAC systems, or accessibility. And this is a statewide program, so these funds are allocated across the system, not only to our system campuses, but to those 19 research and outreach centers and experiment stations. The projects that you see listed are some examples of Heeper projects that you will find in the request coming before you this year. And as I indicated, these are to preserve and replace existing campus facilities in specific categories. We also report to the legislature annually about our progress in distributing those funds and spending those funds. We are actually quite proud of our ability to get these funds spent in a timely fashion. From the funds appropriated in 2011, 98% of the HEPR funds are spent or under contract. The remaining 2% is only for projects that actually came in under budget that could be reallocated then to another project that was on the list, so we could go just a little bit longer or deeper on that list of projects. In 2012, 97% of the projects are spent or under contract. 2013, there was no appropriation. And for 2014, 50% are either spent or under contract, and an additional 40% are in the design phase. So we are able to get that money out the door and get those projects underway very quickly. So HEPR project selection. Again, there's nothing on here that is probably particularly surprising to you. It's a combination of, you know, the critical condition of the facility, how bad is the condition of the facility or a component of the facility, a risk assessment, how vulnerable is it, how quickly might that problem accelerate, or how might it expand to affect other building components or programmatic impact. Health and safety, is there a risk that we need to attend to? Is there a code issue that needs attending to? Is there an HVAC flaw that might create some risk assessment? Building code issues, and particularly if there is a change in law, as you indicated, as you saw, we have many older facilities. On the Twin Cities campus alone, about 30% of our buildings are 80 years old or older. So any code changes obviously would have some great impact. And then programmatic impact. How significant is this in a way that limits our ability to teach or conduct research? That certainly has been also a criteria that's been used in some of our new projects, like the work that's being done to improve the research facilities for our invasive species research. We thought it would be helpful to give you an example of how a building supports program by bringing one of our faculty with us today. It's a little bit more interesting than maybe listening to me for the whole time, or Mr. Bertelsen. So with us today is one of our leading robotics researchers, Dr. Nikos Papanikolopoulos, who is the primary user of the robotics space in Hassalmo Hall. So he is also a distinguished McKnight University faculty member in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering in the College of Science and Engineering, and we encouraged him to join us here today to demonstrate for you some of the work that he has produced within this building and demonstrate the relationship between program and building.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my name is Nikos Papanikolopoulos. I have been with the University of Minnesota for 22 years. And I have with me two of the graduate students working on these programs. So Josh Fassing is a PhD student in computer science and engineering, and Dario Canelon is a PhD student in mechanical engineering.
Excellent. It looks like they're going to do something.
So, if you don't mind, if I could stand up and show you a little bit some of the systems. So, think of. What you see here is actually robots that we call the Antelopods, the Arthropods. So, let me start by this. This was built by a Minnesota kid called Brent Hemis, who came to us and said, I want to build a robot that can tumble. Tumbling means that you move by using your gravity, basically, your weight. So he asked me for $20 million dollars. I told him, you're out of your mind. And we ended up with $2,000, and we built this robot that basically can master a variety of terrains. This is the second or third product we have developed. The first one has been deployed in thousands by the U.S. Army in all over the world. It's called the Minnesota Scout. You might have seen it. This on the news. This one is something that we are currently working, and we try to make it move on the ground and also on the water in order to take samples. For example, we want to evaluate the quality of water in the Mississippi. A system like this can be deployed, and we can collect water samples, and we can bring them back, and we can analyze, and we can create maps of hotspots. So this facility that we moved in 6 months ago is really impressive, but gives us actually competitive advantage on multiple fronts. First of all, we can do a research mission. We can attract more students, more funding. The second one is actually we can attract more faculty as part of the InDrive initiative. We are hiring in robotics. And when we show the facility to people, we are really ecstatic about the quality of the space and also about the functionality of the space. Finally, the thing that is really close to my heart is that this is a great facility in order to appeal to middle school and high school students. Many of you might have kids or grandkids or relatives that are part of all these robotics teams. In fact, we have more robotics teams than hockey teams in Minnesota. This is interesting. So we can change the use of the facility from a research facility where we built to a facility that can hold 100 students, for example, from the Byron Lake School or the Apple Valley High School, where we have programs. So we go and we show the kids on how they can use the math, the physics, and the other sciences in order to do something cool and simultaneously useful. So as a representative of Brian can attest, we have started the program with Brian Lake High School, which with the great staff has allowed us to help create a Fab Lab. So this Fab Lab responding to 100 students. We want to bring the students to the university in order to taste what college life is. And actually this facility enables us to do this. So as we try to expand our activities in the state, this is a great space to use. And trust me, space is a very hot commodity, something that is very difficult to acquire, and it's more difficult actually to manage. So for example, how we can utilize the space in a way that we can accommodate the students, we can accommodate the graduate students, we can accommodate the faculty is a big challenge. But why don't we start this system? Because it's interesting to see that all these systems were built by graduate students like Josh and Dario, and it's a great way of convincing people to come to Minnesota to pursue advanced degrees, stay in Minnesota, create companies, create jobs, and it has been a wonderful
get him!
You can't send him the bill. So this system CQC, it's pretty ruggedized. Now, I don't dare to throw this like the other robot, but again, you can see the creativity of some of these kids and the way that they can take an idea and they can materialize it. And this is actually, when I was a student in Greece, I was doing robotics and I never touched a robot. So it's really a transformative experience to be able to build your ideas, to pursue your ideas. And spaces like this are really enablers towards this
book. What would you use that for?
So this one, let me give you one example of potential use. So let's suppose that we have a math lab where we don't want to send police forces because you have humans and all this stuff. So we can send a robot like this, we can keep the human out of harm's way, and we can transmit all the video, and we can process the case without having a police entering. So if you see, for example, in Afghanistan, They use similar devices in order to deal with improvised explosive devices. The objective is, I don't know what it is. If I lose a robot, it's fine. I mean, it's $5,000. If I lose a serviceman, it's a huge loss. So several of our robots were used there in order to deal directly with improvised explosive devices. We have a situation, for example, of a hostage situation. Unfortunately, we have many of these happening around the world. So Roseville police is using the scout in order, in order to get this information, and the police is actually at the distance of 400 feet, and basically to minimize the exposure of your human resources to environmental risks or other risks.
So we could send it into the DFL caucus room.
No comments. So, again, it's it has been an interesting experience all these years, and also I want to highlight the educational component, which is very, very significant. I mean, we are affecting lives, but I had actually. Representative Bright can attest to this. We heard this kid who said, look, at high school I was not interested at all. I couldn't find something interesting to the point that I touched a 3D printer and I was able to build something. And then I went back home and for the first time I said, look, this is what I learned and this is what I built. And when you hear these stories, you understand. Sometimes we are very narrow-minded in the way we see our work. The when you hear a story, you say, it's just, we have such an impact, or we have the potential of having an impact. And for me, this made my day. I mean, it's really, I never expected that we can have this type of an appeal, I would say.
Very good. Any other questions for the professor? I'm not going to try to say your last name, Professor. I hope you forgive me for that.
Yeah.
Representative Hausman.
I would just be interested to know where the students are from, if we could ask.
I'm from Berkeley, Minnesota.
From Venezuela. And mechanical engineering for the basis of research, so I know what that's about.
Thank you. Representative Albright has a question.
That's not so much a question as an endorsement for the work that Professor Nikos has done in the Prior Lake Savage area, and I think the collaboration between the University of Minnesota and Prior Lake bodes well as a model for what we would hope to provide and make available to school districts across the state. When you think about the opportunity for both boys and girls across many disciplines, you know, in the STEM education, but also the holistic in terms of design, and just engaging people from 9th through 12th, and an opportunity to see beyond what in a rector set, you know, to use that analogy badly, but Professor Nikos has shared, and we share a vision for where his department and the collaboration with high school students can really motivate and propel us as a state in terms of job creation with education and whatnot. I took a tour of his facility prior to when they moved into new space, and I can honestly tell you it was a bit depressing. But what was kind of just inspiring was the students that you have in front of you in terms of their intellect and their desire to overcome the obstacles, whether they be in the apparatus that you see in front of you or the facilities that they have. The day that I was there, they were actually packing up a couple of robots. You have a smile on your face because you know the story I'm going to tell. And I was standing next to you, I think, and I said, well, where are these going? And before that, he was showing me what they do, and they had bladders inside where they actually submerge and take water samples and then come back for water analysis. And I said, well, where are these going? And there were two of them in a big box, and they were packing them up to head off to the airport that day. And he looked at me and said, Fukushima. And the follow-on to that, though, is... And I asked him, he said, well, what happens when they need more than just these two? So from a business development perspective and an opportunity to be entrepreneurial, I think it's just a great opportunity to propel our state forward with this type of opportunity for not only higher ed, but for K through 12 and as we move down into the junior high grades as well. So thank you for coming.
Thank you. Any other questions for the presenters? If not, thank you for coming. It was very enjoyable, and good luck with your future studies, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
While we have a little break here, Representative Vogel would like to move the minutes of the last meeting. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. The minutes are approved. Representative Hausman has a question.
Mr. Chair, the 2015 capital request has three items this morning. I thought I read in the paper that the governor is asking for a start on that university hospital.
Mr. Chair, again, I might ask Mr. Fitzenreiter to provide more detail. The funding is really for the medical school to hire 50 faculty in the supporting space, so it's not a capital request.
Representative Hausman, did you want more information at this time? Okay, very good.
Mr. Chair, as well, the earlier question on the number on this slide, the affordability for the university and the 37,524 students, of that number, 27,833 Minnesota undergrads received financial support for a total of $164.1 million in gift aid.
Very good. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair and members, Representative Hausman is correct. We have the three requests. You've heard a little bit about our HEPA request. The second item is for a vet isolation facility. This project consists of demolishing two obsolete existing isolation buildings. We have significant problems with them. Not only did our accreditation agency indicate that they were an impediment to advancing our program, because of the design and functionality of that space, but they also consume disproportionate energy, and replacing them with new facilities that are more flexible in design, updated and state-of-the-art to accomplish a variety of research study types is an important investment opportunity. That's about 30,000 square feet of space. And the intent, of course, is to enhance the research capability of the University of Minnesota with new ag research facilities that address emerging issues in infectious disease. This is a resource that really has statewide benefit as well. The College of Veterinary Medicine leads key research on infectious disease, diagnosis, recovery, and investigation. And the work is just critical, not only locally within Minnesota, but as well as nationally and within global scales for agriculture. Buildings such as these are highly utilitarian, perhaps, but they are absolutely key to the University of Minnesota's research mission, and they support both basic and applied research that includes graduate student and postdoctoral training for many of the Minnesota's animal health care providers. And then the last project is the greenhouse replacement. This project will create a new greenhouse in the plant growth facility complex. You saw the pictures in the opening video. It's about 9,600 square feet. So this will result in the demolition of the existing obsolete greenhouses and will save energy and operation and maintenance costs and about a 30 to 40% improvement over the current spending. This building is essentially a wing of an existing structure. The space is relatively simple. in terms of structure and material, but the with the addition of temperature and humidity controlled systems to appropriately house the teaching and the research specimen collection used by students in a variety of plant biological science coursework. We're particularly limited right now because we can't accommodate some modulations in the heat and humidity to support the individual research that's going on. It's a big space. It's all of the same. They use the same system, the same setting. So a new space, not only improving and replacing single-pane windows with something that's more energy efficient and effective and other infrastructure investments, but will also result in a space that actually accommodates more individualization of the research that occurs there. The plant collection will be housed in a new space that is highly diverse, and the plant collection represents plant life from around the globe. It's a highly utilized collection and will benefit from co-location with teaching and workrooms currently housed in the plant growth facility. So in summary, we again thank you for your consideration of this request. The state is a very important partner, not only to make sure we have functional buildings, competitive facilities to attract students, faculty, and staff, but that it helps us maintain the affordability of our programs as well. We thank you for your consideration, and we'd be available to answer any additional questions.
Thank you. I believe Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Wheelock, when you demolish a building, does the demolished material just go to a demolition landfill, or is there an attempt at recycling to keep or capture the embedded energy in those old buildings?
Mr. Chair, I'll ask Mr. Bertelsen to respond to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we worked very hard to see what can be reclaimed. We, from furniture, as I mentioned at the beginning, from furniture and interior kind of things, we bring it to a reuse center and see if there's other university users who might be able to use it. Whatever the university doesn't want, we make available to the public. I know that other schools, nonprofit organizations through the cities have come and used and avoid diversion from landfills. We work with the contractors to see what materials can be reclaimed or reused. So we work pretty very hard at trying to divert that from a landfill activity.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
I was looking at your heaper and your energy efficiency and wondered what portion of heaper will be going to that, but I'm specifically looking for how much operating cost you expect to reduce with this energy efficiency.
Mr. Bertelsen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have numbers by each one of them in front of me. You know, that I think that one of the things that there's a couple on there that are specifically about building controls and energy conservation. But one of the things, really, for every project we look at, that's part of our plan. So increasingly over time, in concert with the B3 standards through the state, but really sustainability objectives for the university, we've set a high bar for trying to manage how we utilize any project, and that every project we move forward has an energy conservation component that we're looking at. So I don't have a target for what this particular HEPR request will be to do that. We can try to look into some of that if you'd like. But we're very aggressive with our own resources outside of this as well, funding a large series. And we're routinely recommissioning building systems, like you would update your engine in a car, get a tune-up. We're doing tune-ups and recommissioning of our buildings on a continuous basis. And good examples of that, the things that we've been relighting, all the lights for all the parking ramps, and are saving, you know, around 50% or so of energy for those, because they're using much more efficient lights that are dimmed down. We're doing that through all the buildings and stairways and exits. So it's a significant effort on our part.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I'm glad it's a significant effort, but when we put money out, it's good to see actual numbers. What are we getting? And it's the operating costs. How much? Okay, there's your budget for energy. how much is being reduced by this? Is it, I have no idea, is it 1%? Is it 10%? You know, we have to have some sort of sense of the proportion here.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate the question, so I ought to try to consider that for these particular projects. It's something we're always looking at. One of the major projects that we're working on is a combined heat and power program. It's going to lead to significantly more efficient systems for how we heat and power the campus. We think it's all by itself is going to reduce emissions, the carbon footprint for the campus by 10 to 15% at one project, as well as reduce the university's annual operating cost by approximately $2 million a year. So that is a significant part. And one of the things we are preparing for a presentation tonight, I don't have the stats in front of me, we have been lowering our energy consumption every year. In spite of campus growth, we've continued to lower in our energy consumption relative to our campus and are significantly lower than our peer group that we benchmark against. So that is a very high priority for us. And I appreciate your question. We'll make sure to target the answers to that.
Thank you, Mr. Bertelson. If you could give some more detailed information for Epsilogenius, that would be great. You're done. Representative Dean has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. One question. I mean, does the university, when it looks at the buildings in the operation and the construction or renovation of construction of new or renovation of existing buildings, I mean, do you still silo the capital expense of that building versus ongoing future operational costs? I know that that's one of the things that larger institutions struggle with, is you could make some capital investment pieces in the building early on that are going to have a huge long-term reduction in operational costs, but oftentimes those silos and pots of money can't be co-mingled. I mean, have you been able to make any progress on trying to sort of, I don't know if I'd want to say blur that line of those two versus having that strong delineation when considering the future facility needs?
Mr. Bertelson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, obviously, every project has, at some point, a dollar amount that you build toward. But I'd say there's a couple ways we've gone at that. One is the construction standards that we set. We built into that it has a life cycle cost component to it. So when we're not just looking at a first cost, is I think where you're going with your question. We do consider a life cycle cost when we set and develop our building standards. And if there are opportunities where a marginal investment will have a significant operating payback over time, we have added other resources, be it from energy management, maybe because we're going to lower the energy use into projects in order to get the best available building system or building controls. One of our highest things we're working very hard now is we know that the biggest energy users on campus are research labs more than offices. They produce vastly disproportionate amount of energy for the amount of space. So we have a program we're developing about called, we refer to as smart labs. And it's a national movement we're working with in coalition with other universities across the country, establishing what's the best practices for how you build and design mechanical systems and control systems for labs that can have significant energy reduction. So yes, we are very much attention to that.
Representative Vogel has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just clarification, I thought I heard that the greenhouse was 9,600 square feet, which it would appear then that would come out to like $625 a square foot. I'm just wondering, when we look at these estimates, if indeed that's correct, I might be wrong, then is there equipment included with these a lot of times, or is it just the building, or what would run a building to that kind of money?
Mr. Bertelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'll look to people over to my right for maybe details, or we'll get you some more later about that particular one. But in general, it's not just the shell of the building. It oftentimes, especially for a smaller space like that, the mechanical systems or the equipment costs that go into are included in the project cost. So there are times when the equipment or the system needs, and these greenhouse areas are very system-driven because there's not a lot of space. It's a lot of glaze. Effectively, their former dean used to call them laboratory under glass. So effectively, these are really lab buildings and the kind of building controls and systems. So they're expensive for a very relatively small and intense use space. But we can get you the cost components of this particular one and details, too.
Thank you. I have a question about the veterinary isolation facility. Are you going to demolish the old buildings for that and
yes.
replace it in the same location?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we are going to demolish the existing facilities, and the new facilities will be nearby.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the list of HEPR, which I would call in some ways deferred maintenance, do I take it that anything under $100,000 is coming out of the general operating budget? I guess I wonder what, when you can just easily put a lot of projects on a list, send it off to the capital, $55 million, and we fund it, I mean, where is the responsibility for the university to take care of some of its own deferred maintenance and the new buildings, I mean, to make sure that all the work that needs to be done is being done? How the small dollar amounts, $100,000, seems like, really, you know, we're going to wait for things like that till, the proper, capital investment bill comes along.
Ms. Wheelock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck. I welcome the opportunity to be challenged about a $100,000 request because we're often challenged about, the big requests, too. So it's nice to kind of get both ends of the spectrum covered with our request. But you raise a very good point. I want to reiterate that the university invests in annual R&R through its energy investments, through its housing reinvestment. There are significant sums of money that are spent on an annual basis for the maintenance of our facilities and our inventory. Some of the smaller projects may be, I haven't looked at the list in front of me, but some of the smaller projects, it may be because these are things that are not a departmental responsibility, and so they're integral to the infrastructure. But basically, we look at HEPR and our internal resources and try to figure out how to best allocate those resources. There are things that we spend our internal resources on that are not HEPR eligible. So we look at, where do we have critical needs where we could not use HEPR funding, and we try to have some consistency and some logic between mirroring those requests. And so that's how we approach this. Some of these projects are very big. If you have a roof replacement for Mayo, that's 870,000 or almost 900,000 square feet. That is a big single expense. Some of our buildings are smaller and the expense isn't as big, but it's we have very significant projects that exceed 100,000 that we use internal resources for as well. So it's a marriage between the two, and they are looked at in concert with one another.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up. Ms. Wheelock, did I hear you say that some of these are department decisions?
No, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck. There may be some department resources that they use for their own R&R or improvement of their space. Those tend to be more cosmetic, repainting or carpeting. So between department funds, central funds, energy management, housing, R&R and HEPR, there are significant sources for improvement. The HEPR and the R&R that are centrally managed are the more strategic infrastructure investments on the campuses.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions for today's testifiers? I don't see any. I would like to thank you both for your presentation today. I've been informed that we have a regent in the audience. I don't know if he wants to address us, but I would like to recognize Regent Devine is keeping an eye on his faculty and staff members today, and that's a good thing. We like it when you do your job. So, with that, I believe we are done for the day. This meeting is adjourned.